I'm struggling with the outcome of or the end of a cold, so my voice is going to be strained a little bit. I'll try to keep it up so you can all hear me. No, it's fine. I don't mind. I want to have give and take. I'm not as energetic as I usually am. That's why I've been kind of trying to get over this thing. All right, so let's talk about Micah, the prophet. First, I want to talk about the date, the historical context in which Micah prophesied. And it's going to be a little bit familiar to us because Micah historically comes in the next major period after Jonah. If you remember, Jonah prophesied. Hey, well, how are you? Jonah prophesied at a time when the northern kingdom was in ascendancy. It was growing in power, growing in wealth, growing in might, and the southern kingdom was not so much. It was also, during Jonah's day, it was a time when Syria, the northern, north of the northern kingdom, Israel, was weak, and so that enabled the northern kingdom to begin expanding. Now, the time period we're moving into now is about from the end of King Jotham of Judah's reign, which is around 730. Pen does not work. Around 730 BC to the beginning of Hezekiah's reign, which is going to be around in 715 or so. That's not a little later. These were tumultuous times in the history of these kingdoms. And one of the reasons it was so tumultuous is because in the space between Jotham, king of Judah, and Hezekiah, king of Judah, there was a guy named, who knows the king between those two? Anyone? Yes, very good, Kay. Yes, it's a king Ahaz. Ahaz. Not Ahab. Ahab was the northern kingdom guy. Ahaz is the king in the southern kingdom. We'll talk more about him in a moment, but I want to finish kind of setting up the geopolitical field here. In this period, Israel, the northern kingdom, continues to be very powerful. Syria, though, has risen up and has also become quite powerful. And there's a kind of alliance formed between Syria in the north and Israel, the northern kingdom, against Judah in the south. Israel has formed an alliance with Syria against Judah and Jerusalem. Assyria up here has begun to regain its footing and become more powerful, it's growing and threatening various kingdoms and peoples around them. So that's the political setup. Now, let me just ask you, if you happen to be the king of Judah and Syria and Israel were threatening to invade, what would you do? Pray? That's a good idea. What else would you do? Just think real politics. Think strategy. What would you try to do?
Build
an
alliance
with Israel. There you go. You see, if I were this guy and I was just thinking straight real politics strategy, I would try to get Assyria on my side. Because if you get Assyria on your side, what's going to happen? They're going to come in, and you've gone from a situation which is very untenable, two kingdoms against you, to a place where you've got them surrounded. You can come out on both sides. So that's what we're going to see King Ahaz doing. But before we do that, I want to talk a little bit about these kings, and that's the geopolitical situation, but I want to talk about the spiritual situation. And so to do that, we need to go to 2 Kings chapter 2 Kings chapter 16.
Who was in Syria at this time?
A guy named Rezin. R-E-Z-I-N.
And what kind of people were they?
Assyria or Syrian?
Syria.
I It's a good question. I mean, Semitic peoples, not related,
not Jews.
Not Jews. Right, right.
Did you say First Kings or Second?
Second Kings, chapter 16, and that's chapter 16 begins to tell us a little bit about Ahaz. One day we'll do a Bible study of First and Second Kings. I think that'd be kind of fun to go through all these.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
All these guys. We haven't done that before. Now, if you look up just a few verses prior to chapter 16, you'll see the ending of Jotham's reign. And you can tell me, if you know off the top of your head. If not, we'll read it. What was God's estimation of Jotham as a king? You want to know? Well, he was a basically good guy. Basically a good guy. You can see that in verse 34 of chapter 15, he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord according to what his father Uzziah did. And Uzziah was a good king. Now, verse 35, though, adds a little bit of a cloud here. Nevertheless, the high places were not removed, and the people still sacrificed and made offerings on the high places. What's a high place? Who remembers what a high place is? It is a mountain. But right. It's not just that the mountains there, but what the people had done over the course of centuries, beginning with Solomon, actually, is they had begun to erect altars to other gods, places of worship to other gods on the high places. For whatever reason, we can speculate about that in a minute. For whatever reason, Jotham, king, though he was, descendant of David, good king, worshipped Yahweh, did not remove those high places. Right? So that was a black mark on his record.
Very few of the kings
removed the high places. That's right, Kay. Very few kings actually did remove those high places. And what we see over the course of the history of Judah is that the failure of the kings to root out idolatry and just to go root and branch and take those things out leads over and over again to the subversion of the people. They become more and more loyal to false gods and faithless toward Yahweh because these things are not rooted out. Let's just speculate for a minute. What are some reasons a king might not take these high places down?
Make a lot of people mad.
It would make a lot of people mad, I think. I mean, if this is not state religion, this is folk religion. This is the religion of the people in the high places.
So they were playing politics in a sense.
Well, we're not told this specifically, but I would say that's probably right. I mean, if he removes the high places, he loses a lot of support, a lot of popularity. People aren't going to like that very much. No one likes it when you mess with their religion. Now remember, we're living in a time in Judah where it wasn't that people worshiped false gods and not Yahweh. They just blended everything together. They worshiped Yahweh when they needed Yahweh, and they worshiped Baal when they needed Baal, and they worshiped Molech when they needed Molech. And it all worked together. Whatever you need, you had a god for it. And you didn't want to cut off your access to any of them because they could all give you different things. Remember, the way people thought then was the gods were a means to an end. The gods are a means to a good end that you want. You want good crops? Well, there's a god for that. You want children? There's a god for that. You want wealth? There's a god for that. All of life was ruled by the gods,
Yahweh was the all-in-one God, the all-in-one purpose God, and with him he didn't need any other, because he could do everything. He was the jack of all trades.
God was the jack of all trades. Well, the orthodox, but the faithful teaching of the law was that the other gods are false gods. They're not true gods. They're idol. The idols are either nothing or demonic in origin. And so, yes, God is the God of the heavens and the earth, and he's the one who you need to go to, not to these other gods. That's the teaching of the law. But, you know, just like today, we teach that. Right, we teach that. But just like today, people who our Christians sometimes even will look into things like crystals or look into things like tarot cards or look into begin to experiment in Buddhism or some Eastern practices. The same kind of thing happened then. The very same kind of thing happened then.
I've tried all those things.
You've tried all those things?
Well, I've been through everything.
Right. Well, a lot of people have before they become a Christian. Hopefully, if you're a Christian now, you should get out of those things. Right. So, what is the role of the king of Israel, the king of Judah, I'm sorry, the Davidic king? Because it is a little bit different than what we might think of with our political leaders. It's not the same role. What is the king of Israel, the king of Judah, commissioned to do, anointed to do?
War.
Well,
he's the general of the army.
That's one thing. He's commander. I mean, in that way, it's similar to the president. He's commander in chief. That's right. That's true. Sure, he makes treaties. He does all the normal. Those are things that we would assume that a leader of a nation would do. What are some things that we wouldn't be familiar with a leader of a nation doing that a king of Israel might be called on to do?
To serve in the temple.
Now remember, the Israel is and I'm using Israel and Judah interchangeably here. I don't mean to. I mean Judah because Israel, the northern kingdom at this time, is gone far, far gone from what they originally were supposed to be. But we're talking about a theocracy. When you look at the law, the covenant that God made with Moses, or made with the people of Israel through Moses, and this is especially clear in the book of Deuteronomy, if you read through it, it bears all the marks of a treaty between a human king and a vassal king that you'd see in the ancient Near East. So what it looks like happened is that God took the normal form that kings would use to make a treaty with underlings, and he made it so that the people of Israel didn't have a human overlord, but had God as their overlord. He created in the covenant a kingdom ruled not by a human king, but by God himself. Right? Now, we know that later on in Israelite history, the people rejected God as the absolute monarch, and so they wanted a human king. God gave them a human king, but in David, when that happened, David was not. David didn't. The appointment of David by God was not the ending of the theocracy. It was just a theocracy through a different means. Now God rules through the human king David. David is the one who is obligated not just to fight wars, make treaties, and do all the things that we see leaders doing today, but he was also obligated to hold the people to the law of God, to make sure that Israel stayed faithful to what God said to do. Right? So the high places are really Jotham's problem. Yes, the prophets are preaching against it. Yes, the priests should be speaking against it. But really, the presence of the high places for Jotham, descendant of David, it's his problem. It's his responsibility. He has failed as king in allowing these places to stand and to be. Right, does that make sense? Okay, so now we're going to begin to see in chapter 16 in Ahaz, we are going to begin to see the result. What happens when you don't stamp out idolatry, when you refuse to take action against this kind of thing within the people of God? In the 17th year, this is verse 1 of chapter 16 of 2 Kings, in the 17th year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah, Ahaz, the son of Jotham, king of Judah, began to reign. Now Ahaz was 20 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. And he did not do what was right in the eyes of the Lord his God, as his father David had done, but he walked in the way of the kings of Israel. What's that a reference to?
The northern kingdom
of Israel, right, exactly, good. He even burned his son as an offering. Yeah, that's far gone, isn't it? Now that was something that was associated with the cult of the god Moloch. But it was also done for other gods too. And now put yourself back into an ancient person's mindset. If the value of the offering that you give to your god has an inverse relationship with the blessing that you get as the result of the offering, then it makes great sense to offer the most valuable thing that you have, and that's your child. I mean, in fact,
I suspect that in his case, he did it to appease Israel as much as any god. I suspect he was more of a secularist.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it looks. Let's keep on going, because he seems to buy in pretty fully into the worship of other gods completely. So he sacrifices his own son. Now we know God never calls. He's never said to do that to his people, for his people. And in fact, that's one thing that sets Israel apart from the other nations, is their value, the value they place on human life, and their unwillingness to sacrifice their children to any god or goddess. So he's now stepped far, far, far beyond the covenant.
Do you think that's part of the reason for the story with Abraham and Isaac, when he almost does it, but he doesn't do it?
Yeah, that's a great illustration. I mean, because God, in Genesis 22, seems to step out of character. What are you calling us to sacrifice? What are you calling Abraham to sacrifice his son for? Ultimately, we see that God was disciplining, testing, tempering Abraham's faith, and wasn't really going to demand that of him. But yeah, that the reason Genesis 22 is so shocking is because Yahweh doesn't do that. Yahweh hasn't ever called him that. Hi, Chuck. What would you like?
Go on. You're good.
No, I don't want you to talk. Have a side conversation. I want you to talk, because you can sit here with a Bible study, but
I can get some main correctors.
Sure, absolutely. Go for it. Okay.
Thank you.
Then you can get whatever you see in there you want. Go ahead and take it. All right. So, where were we? Burned his son as an offering according to the despicable practices of the nations whom the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. So, like Anne was saying, this really marks him off as taking a step away from what Yahweh would command. Verse 4, and he sacrificed and made offerings on the high places and on the hills and under every green tree. So it's complete. The word for this is apostasy. He's become an apostate. He's forsaken his God. All right, now look at verse 5. This is where the crisis comes in, and this is all set the setting for Micah's ministry. Then Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, the king of Israel, came up to wage war in Jerusalem. You see that? The northern kingdom of Israel and Syria decide that they're going to take out Judah, or at least make Judah subject to their power. But they could not conquer him. At that time, Rezin, the king of Syria, recovered Elath for Syria and drove the men of Judah from Elath, and the Edomites came to Elath, where they dwell to this day. Now, verse 7 is where Ahaz... Now, this should be completely in character. Well, let me just ask you before we get to verse 7. What should Ahaz do? He sees his enemies gaining territory, gaining ground. What should Ahaz do? As a leader, an anointed king of Israel, descendant of David, where should he go?
The temple.
Repent, right? This is a crisis of enormous proportions. The king is the mediator between man and between God and his people, and this is the opportunity that Ahaz has to fall down in the temple and beg for mercy from Yahweh. And so what does he do instead? Where does he go? So Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, the king of Assyria. See that? He goes to Assyria.
All the silver and the gold and everything that was in the temple and gave it to
right. Now, just a minute ago, I asked you what you would do if you're, you know, just now geopolitically, what Ahaz does makes perfect sense, doesn't it? It's the practical, pragmatic step to take. But this shows us, I think, how sometimes pragmatics and practicality, especially when we're already in a place of disobedience and unfaithfulness, sometimes tends to make us to dig the hole deeper, which is what Ahaz has done. Instead of the opportunity he had to repent, he doesn't repent. He goes and seeks help from another kingdom and another power. Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. Well, you, I mean...
In my experience, too, I say it always works that way. Always. You just cannot compromise principles that are essential.
Mm-hmm.
You can't.
To maybe give a little more humanity to Ahaz, I mean, think about it. I mean, when you go... When I'm in places where I've been disobedient for a while, sometimes I get to the point where I think, well, God's not going to listen to me anyway. So I need to fix this problem myself. I'm on my own now. God won't listen. Because we are people who believe in works righteousness.
Don't mistake that for me saying I don't do it.
No, I know. I'm just saying by nature human beings think that God operates like we do.
Yeah.
Like that if we do good for him, he's going to do good for us. If we give him good stuff, he's going to give good stuff to us. If we do bad to him, he's going to do bad to us. So if we've dug ourselves a hole, we can't repent because we're on our own now. We've got to find some other way to make this happen.
Or, you know, you try to appease the enemy. You know, the silver and gold seems like a way to say,
right, well, he has no hope. He knows if he doesn't do something, his kingdom is going to be wrested from him. So the only hope that he sees at this point, because he's dug himself so far away, a hole so far and so deeply, that he doesn't think he can go to the Yahweh anymore, the only thing he can see that he can do is go to another god, Tiglath-Pileser, the king of Assyria, and seek help. And so he tries to pay the Assyrians to come in and aid him. And it works! It works. Now, look what he's willing to give him, too. And I think you mentioned this a minute ago. He says to Tiglath-Pileser, I'm your servant and your son. Come up. That's covenant language. That's covenant language. I'm your son. You know, the kings of Israel, David, Solomon, all of them are considered to be God's sons. And here he's saying, I'm your son, king of Assyria. I'm your servant and your son. Come up and rescue me from the hand of the king of Syria and from the hand of the king of Israel who are attacking me. Ahaz also took the silver and the gold that was found in the house of the Lord and the treasuries of the king's house and sent a present to the king of Assyria. And the king of Assyria listened to him. And the king of Assyria marched up against Damascus and took it, carrying its people captive to Kir. And he killed the Rezin. What was the price? What's the price that Ahaz had to pay to save his skin? Yeah, I mean, the signs and the symbols of the covenant that God gave to Moses or to the people through Moses, the structures that God called to be built and placed in his house, or at least his symbolic house, the temple, he was willing to trade those in order to save himself. But he was unwilling to humble himself before Yahweh. It's so, so interesting. It's what pride does. All right, so now what Ahaz has done is he has sold himself and he's become the servant of Assyria. He's become the servant of Assyria. He's established a covenant with him. Assyria has in some ways become the Lord. Remember how I told you in the covenant framework, Yahweh is the Lord of Israel. Now Assyria is, and it's going to have some real practical effects on the worship in Jerusalem. Look at what happens here. So King Ahaz goes to Damascus. He meets with Tiglath-Pileser. That's right up here. Damascus was Syrian territory. This is now conquered area because Assyria has come in and saved Judah by invading Syria. So Ahaz goes up and meets with him in Damascus. And King Ahaz after this meeting, sends to Uriah the priest, that's the priest in the Jerusalem temple, a model of the altar from Assyria, from the Damascus, from the god that Tiglath-Pileser is worshiping. And its pattern, exact in all its details. If you go back and you read Exodus 35, 36, and you read all that section of Exodus, and you read that the very specific, particular detail that God gives when he delivers the model for the tabernacle to Moses, that's what's going on here. But it's Ahaz, but it's now Tiglath-Pileser giving a model to Ahaz. And when the king, and Uriah the priest built the altar. What do you do if you're Uriah the priest and you get these blueprints? What do you do? How do you respond?
He just did what he was told.
Huh?
He just did what he was told.
Was it good to do what he was told?
No, it wasn't good.
Right. See, I mean, this is one of those cases. I mean, the Bible does say you obey the authorities that are placed over you. But in this case, the priest had a higher authority, Yahweh, that he was willing to betray, and he didn't. So the priest now is implicated. The high priest is implicated in this idolatry. The one who is supposed to guard the temple has refused to guard it.
Supposing that Uriah decided against it, didn't do it, what would happen? He would be killed, probably.
Probably. Yeah. That Kate makes a good point. I mean, if Uriah didn't do it, he would risk his life, and that's absolutely true. And that's also what Jesus tells us, isn't it? I mean, it's if you save your life in this world, you'll lose it. But if you lose your life for my sake, you gain it. That's sometimes the choice that disciples have, the followers of Yahweh have. It was the same then as it is now. So Uriah the priest built the altar in accordance with all the king Ahaz had sent to Damascus, or from Damascus. So Uriah the priest made it. Before King Ahaz arrived from Damascus, he worked fast and hard. Verse 12. And when the king came from Damascus, the king viewed the altar. Then the king drew near the altar and went up on it and burned his burnt offering and his grain offering and poured his drink offering and threw the blood of his peace offerings on the altar. And the bronze altar that was before the Lord, he removed from the house, from the place between his altar and the house of the Lord, and put it on the north side of the altar. He just rearranged. If you go back all the way through verses 15, I mean, he reconsecrates a new temple dedicated to new gods. I mean, and I wouldn't necessarily say he stops worshiping Yahweh. He's probably still doing that too. But we now have a new sovereign. Yahweh is no longer sovereign. It's the god of Tiglath-Pileser. Huge. This has not happened yet in the history of Judah. This is a big, big move. Complete apostasy. So this continues for the entirety of Ahaz's reign. For the entire 15 years, 16 years of his reign, this new temple worship is in effect. And Israel is, or Judah is, subject to Assyria. Now we're told there in verse 19... the rest of the acts of Ahaz, all he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? We don't have that anymore. That's not a reference to the book of First and Second Chronicles. That's a reference to a book we don't really have. And Ahaz slept with his fathers and was buried with his fathers in the city of David. And Hezekiah, his son, reigned in his place. And thanks be to God, because Hezekiah turns out to be a good boy. We don't know. It's not because you had a good dad. This is the grace of God. This is how sometimes if you have, even if you see somebody who has bad and unfaithful parents, you shouldn't despair, because God can, God's grace can overwhelm that and overcome that. And it seems to be the case here with Hezekiah, because immediately he rebels. You can see that in chapter 18 is when we begin to hear about Hezekiah. In the third year of Hoshea, son of Elah, king of Israel, Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign. He was 25 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem, long reign. His mother's name is Abi, the daughter of Zechariah, and he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord according to all that his father David had done. Look at verse 4. Huge. He removed the high places. Do you see that? So few kings of Judah removed the high places. He did a thoroughgoing reform. This is what reformation looks like. This is what revival looks like. So tearing down of the high places in a church, in your life. It's a thoroughgoing rooting out of sin and idolatry. The Asherah pole, to the best we can understand, it was a symbol of fruitfulness or plenty, both sexually and with regard to crops. Yeah, you'd stick the pole in the ground, and to be crass, that represents the male and the female. And then people would even have rites where they would have various sexual experiences there, and that would be so. It was horrible, it was a horrific thing, and so Hezekiah got rid of them. But you can see why it was popular, right? I mean, you can see why people liked that particular form of worship, right? It was something that people liked. So, in any case, Hezekiah did away with the high places. Again, this is reform. This is revival. This is what it looks like in your life too. You have high places in your heart. You have high places in your mind. You have high places in your family life. And in the church, we have high places. And we must always be reforming with God's help, ourselves, the church, and our families. It's so, so important not to let those high places remain. So Hezekiah breaks them to pieces. Verse 4, he removed the high places and broke the pillars and cut down the Asherah, and he broke in pieces the bronze serpent. Remember this thing that Moses had made, and for until those days the people of Israel had made offerings to it. It was called Nehushtan. So God tells him to make this golden serpent to heal them from the poisonous wounds that the serpents gave them when the people were grumbling as they walked across the desert. Remember that? Mm-hmm. And that's later on what Jesus says represents that raising of this golden serpent on the stick was a preview or a type of crucifixion. Mm-hmm. He was going to be that gold snake. Mm-hmm. That people were going to look at and be healed. He was going to be sin personified. Mm-hmm. So that had become the people had made that into an idol, and they began to worship that. So verse 5, he trusted in the Lord, the God of Israel. Man, that's a great, so few kings. If you read this book, this is like a breath of fresh air to read this. He trusted in the Lord God. That's faith. He trusted in Yahweh. And Yahweh was with him, for he held fast. Okay, so there was none like him among all the kings of Judah after him, nor among those who were before him, for he held fast to the Lord. He did not depart from following him, but kept the commandments that the Lord commanded Moses. Now, some people suggest that the reason Hezekiah turned out so much different than his father is because of the prophet we're going to be studying. Or at least in part because of the prophet that we're going to be studying, Micah. Because Micah was a prophet who preached during Ahaz's reign and called Ahaz to account and called the people to account. And so it could be, we don't know for sure, we're not told why exactly, but it could be that God used the word of his word spoken through Micah to bring Hezekiah to his knees and to faith.
I'm a little bit confused this morning. I don't know what's going on in my head, but this may be a stupid question, but I thought during the reign of Ahaz, the people were carried off to Assyria.
You're thinking about the northern kingdom. So, in the northern kingdom, that happened, and that actually happened during the beginning of Hezekiah's reign. Remember, because Ahaz made an alliance with Assyria. Assyria invaded.
That's why they left him alone.
Yeah, they left him alone. Okay. Right. So, but when Hezekiah is going to rebel against their new god, Assyria, and Assyria is not going to take that very, very well, and they're going to invade Judah And they've already taken Israel. They're going to take most of Judah, and they're going to wind up at the gates of Jerusalem because of Hezekiah's refusal to serve Assyria. And Hezekiah's afraid, but there's another prophet there at that time to support him. Does anyone know who that prophet is? Yes, Kay, you're just on fire today. That's the yeah, I think,
he's
yes.
The one who stripped away the birthright, for whom God stripped
right.
away the birthright and said, I've had enough of you kings.
Right, right. Isaiah was there during the siege of Jerusalem, saying to Hezekiah, you know, you see hundreds of thousands of Assyrian troops outside your walls, don't worry. No problem. No problem. They come out to meet. They have this meeting with the heralds from Sennacherib. That's the Assyrian king. They come out, and the heralds from Sennacherib yell up to the walls of Jerusalem and say, "Don't let Hezekiah fool you. Don't let Hezekiah fool you. No god of any people has been able to rescue them from our power, and neither will yours." They were speaking in Hebrew, so that the people could hear them and understand what they were saying. And the Israelite or the Judah messengers who are meeting with them are saying, "Hey, you know, speak in another language here, speak in the common language, so that people can't understand what you're saying." And that just drove it further. Why should we speak in a language that people can't hear? Because it's they who are going to have to eat their children. It's they who are going to have to feed on their waste because of this siege. So let them have a choice. And so Hezekiah is up there on the wall and he's freaking out. Then that's when Isaiah comes to him and says, "Well, don't worry, because tomorrow they're all going to be gone." And that night, God struck the army with a plague. 100,000 of them died. And the army moved off. So just amazing the way God acted. So that's the drama. This is the 17-year unfolding drama, beginning with Ahaz's takeover from Jotham. That's the backdrop for everything we read in Micah. Are there any questions about this kind of this setup that we've gone through? Any thoughts?
Well, that explains why the first chapter of Micah never made sense to me.
Why is that?
It's just too much history involved for me to know what was going on.
Yeah, yeah, you really got to go back to 2 Kings and look through what was going on.
I'm going to blow your horn here a little bit. I've studied formally all kinds of theology and what's called Bible stuff, and it's all about principles and theological concepts, but until we started attending here, I've never heard the Bible itself, its history and lessons preached anywhere, ever. And, you know, it just doesn't happen.
I'll have to get a recording of that and put it on a headset.
But quite seriously,
just kidding. Thank you.
I already knew. I've never been exposed to this stuff. When I've read the Bible, and I've read it, you know, for years, I've read it for the principles that are involved, and just totally missed all the principles that are embedded in the history and embedded in the personalities and embedded in the regions that are involved. It's like reading between the lines.
Well, thanks be to God for that. I mean, that's the great thing about the Bible. It's really, I mean, all I have to do is tell you what the thing says, because itself, it has so much power, and I mean, God has embedded so much there that you miss if you just don't do it. Right.
Stephen attached himself to the carriage. And the Ethiopian said, "How can I know without a teacher? How would I know to go to 2 Kings to find out what this first chapter of Micah is all about?" We were reading together the other night, and I said, "Don't worry about that. Wait till we get to the good stuff here in chapter 2.
Right, right, right. Well, it's all, I mean, you do, actually, what you just said a minute ago is absolutely right, because you have to do chapter 2 and chapter 1 together, I think, we're going to read chapter 1 and chapter 2. But we're going to actually dive into chapter 2 to see what the indictment is, and then we're going to go back to chapter 1 to see the punishment, because we have the punishment from God given to us in chapter 1. We have the reason for the punishment in chapter 2. So it's kind of a backwards verdict, but we'll look at that in a minute. Is everyone, thank you also, and thanks be to God, but thank you for what you said. Does anyone have any other questions or comments about the review so far? Does everyone get it? Does everyone understand the situation, the circumstances? Everyone? Okay, well, let's go ahead and just dive in then, and we'll look at chapter 1 and chapter 2 together. So I want to read those both. It's going to be a little bit long, but that's okay. We can get our minds around it. And if we have to stop, we have to stop. I'll go ahead and read the first chapter, and I'll pass it up to someone else. There's a lot of names here that if you just read quickly and confidently, even if you don't pronounce it right, people think you do. You got it, so that's what I'll do. The word of the Lord came to Micah of Moresheth in the days of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, the kings of Judah, which he saw concerning Samaria and Jerusalem. Hear, you peoples, all of you, pay attention, O earth, and all that is in it, and let the Lord God be a witness against you, the Lord from his holy temple. For behold, the Lord is coming out of his place and will come down and tread upon the high places of the earth, and the mountains will melt under him, and the valleys will split open like wax before the fire, like waters poured down a steep place. All this is for the transgression of Jacob and for the sins of the house of Israel. What is the transgression of Jacob? Is it not Samaria? And what is the high place of Judah? Is it not Jerusalem? Therefore I will make Samaria a heap in the open country, a place for planting vineyards, and I will pour down her stones into the valley and uncover her foundations. All her carved images shall be beaten to pieces, all her wages shall be burned with fire, and all her idols I will lay waste. For from the fee of a prostitute she gathered them, and to the fee of a prostitute they shall return. For this I will lament and wail. I will go stripped and naked. I will make lamentation like the jackals and mourning like the ostriches. For her wound is incurable, and it has come to Judah. It has reached to the gate of my people, to Jerusalem. Tell it not in Gath, weep not at all. In Beth Laphra, roll yourselves in the dust. Pass on your way, inhabitants of Shaphir, in nakedness and shame. The inhabitants of Zanaan, do not come out. The lamentation of Beth Ezel shall take away from you its standing place. For the inhabitants of Meroth wait anxiously for good, because disaster has come down from the Lord to the gate of Jerusalem. Harness the steeds to the chariots, inhabitants of Lachish. He was the beginning of sin to the daughter of Zion, for in you were found the transgressions of Israel. Therefore you shall give parting gifts to Moresheth-Gath. The houses of Achzib shall be a deceitful thing to the kings of Israel. I will again bring a conqueror to you, inhabitants of Mereshah. The glory of Israel shall come to Adullam. Make yourselves bald. Cut off your hair for the children of your delight. Make yourselves as bald as the eagle, and they shall go from you into exile. All right, would someone like to read chapter 2? Okay.
Allots our fields. Therefore you will have none to cast the wine by lot when you come to the Lord. Do not preach, thus they preach. One should not preach of such things. Disgrace the mark of a prophet. Should be said, O house of Jacob, has the Lord grown impatient? Are these his deeds? Do not my words do good to him who walks uprightly? But lately my people have risen up as an enemy. You strip the rich robe from those who pass by trusting you, with no thought of war. The woman of my people you drive out from their delightful houses. From their young children you take away my splendor forever. Arise and go, for this is no place to rest. Because of uncleanness that destroys, this is grievous destruction. If a man should go about and utter wind and lies, saying, I will preach to you of wine and strong drink, he would be the preacher of this people. I will surely assemble all of you, O Jacob. I will gather the remnant of Israel. I will set them together like sheep in a fold, like a flock in its pasture, a noisy multitude of men. He who opens the breach goes up before them. They break through and pass the gate, going out by it. Their king passes on before them, the Lord at their head.
Okay, excellent. Great, thank you. So, I think you can see what begins in chapter 1 is the announcement of what's going to happen as the result of their disobedience. Chapter 2 is description of their disobedience. Chapter 2 is what's happened as a result of the idolatry that Ahaz has led the southern kingdom into, and in some ways also the idolatry that the northern kingdom has been involved with for a long time. We've talked about that many, many times in this class, so you know that fairly well. So I do want to actually start with chapter 2, which is going to be not something we do normally, but I do think we should start with chapter 2 and then bridge back into chapter 1 and see what's going on. Now, think of this as a law court scene, because what Micah is doing is he's acting as the Lord's advocate, the Lord's attorney. Think the DA, right? He's now laying down what crimes have been committed, and then we're going to look at what the punishment will be as a result of those crimes. All right, so let's just start in chapter 2. Woe to those. I should say a little bit about who Micah is. Notice in verse 1 of chapter 1, he comes from Moresheth. Now, this is unique. Micah, most prophets say, hey, I'm the son of this person, the son of that person. Micah doesn't do that. He says where he's from. Moresheth is 20 miles about southwest of Jerusalem. It's on the outskirts of Gath, which is a Philistine area. He's a prophet from Judah, therefore. And then he also gives this reigns of the kings in which he prophesied. Now, one thing concerning this is that, or one thing that is unique about this is Micah also doesn't give us a story of his call. Because many other prophets say, hey, I was doing this and God called me to be his prophet. Micah doesn't do that. We don't know much about his background at all. We just know that he was a prophet during this period of time, and his prophecy concerned both Samaria, what's that? The northern kingdom, and Jerusalem, the southern kingdom, the capital of the southern kingdom. All right, now, chapter 2, verse 1. Woe to those who devise wickedness and work evil on their beds. Devise wickedness and work evil on their beds. What's the imagery here suggesting?
So lying awake at night, dreaming up all kinds of horrible things.
Yeah. How can I sin tomorrow? In what way can I make pleasure for myself? Or, you know, just... I don't think it's something that we're completely unfamiliar with. right. It's not. I can think of, a lot of times sin takes planning. I can, just to go back to my old days, not that I don't do it now, but this is the thing that popped into my head. It took a lot of planning for us to figure out how to go down on, as soon as school ended, high school, in my senior year, we would go down every Friday night, down a two-hour drive across the border to Mexico, get the booze, bring it back up, and then we'd be set for the weekend, or maybe we'd buy enough so we'd be set for a few weekends, but we had to plan how we're going to lie to our parents, how we're going to get the money for gas, how we're going to... All that stuff took a lot of constructing to do. Oh, no, it's not. No, it's not. That's one reason we went to Mexico, though, because... You could, if you can see over the counter in Mexico, right. Those days you could. Now probably not. In the 80s, it was a little bit easier. I don't want to talk about that. But I do want to talk about the way sin has wormed its way into the lives of the people, and that's the imagery here. Is that people plan it. They plan it out. They strategize new ways, new and interesting ways to disobey God, new and interesting ways to be disobedient to Him. When the morning dawns, they perform their plan. They do what they've said because it is in their it is in the power of their hand. Now that's interesting too. God is, you know, there's this frequently in the scriptures you see that one of the ways that God exhibits His anger and wrath toward His people is by just letting them have the power to do what they want to do. Right, right. So go ahead. Do your will. And that's what seems to be going on here. And we're going to have to stop because we are now at...